Radiolab is supported by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call the shots on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Radiolab is supported by the John Templeton Foundation, funding research and catalyzing conversations that inspire people with awe and wonder. Learn about the researchers making the latest discoveries in the science of well-being, complexity, forgiveness, and free will at templeton.org/podcast.
Listener supported, WNYC Studios.
Wait, you're listening.
Okay.
All right.
Okay.
All right.
You're listening to Radiolab.
Radio
from
WNYC.
See?
Yep.
Hey, I'm Jad Abumrad.
I am Robert Krolwich.
This is Radiolab.
Today we want to talk about someone.
Sort of a tribute. Is that the right word?
Yeah,
maybe so.
It is.
Yeah. We're going to play a couple stories of his.
We can't seem to stop remembering him.
Yeah, exactly. So we're going to play a few stories of him on Radiolab. And the first one, do you want to set up the first one?
Yeah, this was at the Brooklyn Academy of Music, a packed house, really like thousands of people sort of sitting there. And we just said.
Had he died yet?
No. He was, I think.
No, he was sick at this point.
He was very sick, yeah. He wasn't able to come on the stage, so we just delivered it. So all those thousands of people closed their eyes, and they heard what you're about to hear.
So we want to finish the night with a salute to a guy who's been on our program and part of our family pretty much from the beginning. I have known him for more than 35 years. Early on when Radiolab started, I asked him if he'd help us out and send us a few story ideas. He didn't send us a few. He sent us bushels, tales of chemistry and medicine, hallucinations, music, people, so many extraordinary people that he knew or found or helped, because the guy just doesn't run out. Dr. Oliver Sacks, neurologist, author. He's a guy who notices everything. He's deeply interested in everything that happens around him and to him. And tonight we're bringing him back on tape for what, alas, may be his final offering for us. As many of you know, Dr. Sacks recently was diagnosed with liver cancer, and he wrote about this in the New York Times. He said he plans to spend the time that he has left writing, being with friends, not doing interviews, but he did agree to share his thoughts exclusively with us tonight for you gathered here, because he's one of our family. So as I've done for decades now, I went over to his house in Manhattan with my mic, and I said to him, I just need to know like what just happened. A month and a half ago, you were fine, and then what?
At the beginning of the year, I was fine. On the 3rd of January, I felt a little queer, and I passed some dark urine. I thought I had a little gallbladder attack, and didn't pay that much attention, but thought I'd better get things checked. And the x-ray, which was expected only to show a couple of gallstones, showed hundreds of cysts in my liver. Although my doctor said he didn't know what these were and I would need further tests, I knew what they were. I said, it's happened.
And he was right. The doctors eventually confirmed that a cancer that had been found in his eye 9 years ago had spread to his liver. Were you frightened or relieved or consoled or what?
No, I think my first feeling was one of overwhelming sadness. There are all sorts of things I won't see and I won't do. One or two people have written to me, and, you know, consolingly and said, well, you know, we all die. But it's not like we all die. It's like you have 4 months.
What is your prognosis at this moment? Because I know you had an
op. Oh, right. It gets revised.
It depends, of course, on how the cancer responds to treatments and
or how quickly it spreads?
So far, the metastases from my eye are only in my liver. I'm told they love liver. Actually, I love liver as well. And one of the magical things I did was to go and have liver and onions soon after the diagnosis. Yes.
Oh, wow.
And thinking that liver looks better than mine, probably.
See, this is what he's like. Instead of being frightened by the thing that's trying to kill him, he's thinking about loving liver and liver lovers and looking for connections and wondering. And he doesn't stop. He just notices it. Case in point, a few months ago, his doctor said to him, we're going to run a line up your liver, and in effect, we're going to try to shave off or starve some of the cancer cells, first on one side, then on the other, to see if we can give you a little more time. But they warned him.
As the metastases die, they put out various unpleasant chemicals.
That may exhaust you, tax your system badly.
And at one point,
shortly after the procedures,
I started talking a little strangely. And as I was talking, I was also writing. You will be the first person to see this.
So he showed me a notebook, and we're showing it to you in just a moment. You can see there's sort of writing there on the left. He's writing a book, actually a children's book about the elementary table. But as he was writing, if you look to the next page, if you can see that, it gets a little bit wobbly, the letters.
And then there was some crossing out there.
Yes, I see.
And then rather dramatically, the writing changes.
It actually, there's a large slash across it, and then it seems a little incoherent at the bottom.
Yes. Okay.
And then it turns to pure scribble.
That is delirium. It crept up on me. All this happened in the course of 10 minutes.
And I see what he's doing here. He's figuring, okay, I'm writing at a constant speed. I know pretty much how fast I write. And so I can time this out. I can figure out exactly how long it took me to slip into delirium and then out of this delirium. And he's doing this very, very sick man. It's science all the time.
To write it out in a more medical way, I think this would form a lovely illustration. You put in a timeline of delirium just coming like that.
Why aren't you more frightened? Like, unusual for any doctor and a man of science, you don't seem to worry at all when things become incoherent or strange. You're now showing it to me as if, like, ooh, how interesting. I was crazy here for a little bit.
Yeah.
The truth is, Oliver is fascinated by what goes on in the human mind, no matter how strange it gets up there. At one time, when he was a young resident in California driving his bike, and by the way, I should show you what he looked like back then when he was driving his bike. This, I think, is him in New York. A kind of, you know. And in the 60s, he was also a champion weightlifter. They called him Dr. Squat. And in this picture that we're showing you here, that's him raising 600 pounds in order to win a trophy. Like, he was a champ. And in any case, at this time, in the 1960s, in addition to being all muscled out, Oliver was a serious recreational drug taker. And because he's Oliver, he was extremely curious about his highs, no matter how weird they were. One time, for example, he took 20 pills that he shouldn't have.
And then, to my surprise, there was a spider on the wall which said, hello. It had a voice like Bertrand Russell.
The famous mathematician.
And it asked me a rather technical question as to whether Russell had exploded Frege's paradox. And we had this conversation.
You answered the spider?
Sure, I answered the spider.
You discussed Frege's paradox with the spider?
I did indeed, because you trust your perceptions.
Okay.
Many years later, when I mentioned this to an entomologist friend at Cornell, the philosophical spider, he said, yes, he said, I know the species.
So thinking Oliver's way, taking it all in, talking spiders, whatever, the generosity of his curiosity becomes profoundly moving and transformative when he's treating his patients. I want to tell one story here really quickly to demonstrate what I mean. Oliver once had a patient whom he called Mrs. O.C. She was an old woman. She was 88 years old, living in a nursing home. And one night she was awakened, jarred awake, by a loud sound. It was a song.
There I'd sit and cry.
And she thought, well, somebody's left the radio on. But when she looked, the radio in the room was off. Her roommate sound asleep, which was odd because the song was really loud. And after that, there was another song. And then another song. And Mrs. Osi thought, well, maybe my roommate can't hear these songs because the songs are coming through the fillings in my teeth. I've heard that's possible. But no, her doctors told her, this is something in your head. You need to see a neurologist, which led her to Dr. Sachs. Now, when he met Mrs. Osi, she could barely hear him. The songs sung by the female voice were coming and coming. She was frightened and justifiably worried that she was going crazy. But Oliver said, no, I'm going to do some tests. And when he was done, he said he'd found a slight stroke or condition that had triggered musical epilepsy, the sudden production of music in her brain. Now, a normal doctor might say, okay, we've got the diagnosis, and he thought that the songs would probably fade and it'll pass, so they would be done. But Oliver did not stop. He doesn't stop. He kept talking to her. She told him she was born in Ireland in the 1890s. Her father died before she was born, her mother when she was only five.
Orphaned, alone, she was sent to America to live with a rather forbidding maiden aunt. She had no conscious memory of the first 5 years of her life, no memory of her mother, of Ireland. She had always felt this as a keen and painful sadness, this lack or forgetting of the earliest, most precious years of her life.
So he asked her about the songs. What are they like? And Mrs. Osi said, well, I think they're lullabies. Can you sing them for me? She did. And then after checking with, I'm not sure who, Oliver figured out that these songs were happened to be popular Irish ballads from the 1890s when Mrs. Osi was a little baby. And that gave him an idea. Now, what he does next isn't science. It isn't in any traditional way medicine. He just told her a story. And it goes like this. You know how nobody remembers anything that happens to you when you're one or two or three? Well, there was a theory once, not honored much today, but it said that those earliest memories get locked away deep in our brains in a special safe that we can never open. So let's suppose, Mrs. Osi, that your stroke, by some crazy chance, opened the lock that none of us can break and released those first memories in you, just for a little while, so that the voice you're listening to...
There's a home by the great oven mold.
Maybe that isn't a radio voice. Let's say that it's your mother's voice. That's your missing mother. And so at the ripe old age of 88, you finally get to be back in your mother's arms. You get to be a baby again. And Mrs. Osi thought about that and said, okay, it sort of fits.
I'm an old woman with a stroke in an old people's home, but I feel I'm a child in Ireland again. I feel my mother's arms. I see her. I hear her voice singing.
The green ivy clings round the door, and the bird sings.
Shortly thereafter, the songs began to fade, the pauses widened. Mrs. Osi, who'd been so frightened by this music in her head, was now sorry to see the songs go. But it was Oliver who noticed how those songs had touched her, who noticed that the songs might become a comfort to her because that's what he does. He listens closely. He can hear another person's heart. And this is really the profound puzzle for me of Oliver, because reading the new autobiography, you see that while he was so full of heart as a doctor in his own life and in the relationships that really mattered, it turns out he didn't get a whole lot of affection. He was, for a long time, a lonely guy. I'd say he was very lonely. And he's talking about that now for the first time. Well, let me talk about love for a minute. In this book, you tell the story of your very first love, a fellow by the name of Richard Selig. Can you just tell me what happened with him?
He was a Rhodes Scholar at Oxford and a poet, and handsome and beautiful beyond belief. And I sort of fell for him, although I didn't say anything because I was very haunted by my mother's accusations.
What did your mother?
To go a couple of years back then, my father had opened a conversation. I was about to go to Oxford, and a sort of father-son conversation. And he said, you don't seem to have many girlfriends. And I said, no, wishing the conversation would stop. He said, something wrong with girls? And I said, no, they're fine. Perhaps you prefer boys. And I said, well, yes, I do. I said, I've never done anything, but I do.
And you knew that then?
I knew that then. I'd known it for 6 years, probably since I was 12. And I said, don't tell Ma. She won't be able to take it. But my father did tell my mother in the night, and the next morning she came down with, I somehow want to say, a face of thunder, and raged at me, and among other things said, you're an abomination, I wish you had never been born. And then she suddenly shut up and said nothing for 3 days. And the matter was never mentioned again in her lifetime. And then, 2 years later, I found myself for the first time in my life falling in love.
And this was the young guy, Richard. Oliver at the time was in college.
It was a very positive feeling, though I didn't know whether it was one which I dared express. But I did say so with my heart and my mouth to Richard.
What did you remember what you said?
I said, I'm in love with you. Huh. And Richard gripped me by the shoulders and he said, I know. He said, but I'm not that way, but I love you in my own way. And I was glad I had said it and glad that it had been received in such a warm, friendly way. I thought we might be friends for the rest of our lives. But then one day he came into me, said he'd been bothered by finding a lump in his groin.
And he was worried.
Could I have a look at it? And I looked at it and I felt it, and it was hard and tethered. It turned out to be a particularly malignant form of lymphoid tumor, what was called a lymphosarcoma. And he never spoke to me again after that. I don't know whether, since I'd been the first to recognize the ominous import, I don't know whether he saw me as a harbinger of death or a messenger of death, whatever.
But you were left with that silence.
Yeah.
A few years later, Oliver met a man named Mel. He was young, he was a sailor. Like Oliver, he was into weightlifting. They became close friends, and they began living together.
I adored him and was in love with him and loved physical contact with him.
And they'd work out, and they'd wrestle and ride motorcycles kind of tightly, and they never talked about what might or might not be happening between them. But one day, they were together, and Oliver was giving Mel a back massage, which Mel often asked him to do.
And I loved doing that.
And Oliver says sometimes he'd get a little, you know, excited.
And so long as I gave no explicit indication, it was okay. But one day, things went a bit too far, and I got sort of, I went over the brink instead of just before the brink. Mel immediately sort of got up and had a shower and said, I can't stay with you anymore. And I found that very cruel and upsetting and heartbreaking, and it made me feel I don't want to have anything to do with people. I mustn't fall in love. I cannot share lives with anyone again.
And he didn't share his life with anyone for a long, long time. In fact, he told me a story about something that happened to him maybe 8 years ago.
I was just joining the faculty at Columbia, and I was having a sort of an interview. And at one point, the interviewer said to me, she said, I have something rather private to ask you. Would you like Miss Edgar, your assistant, to leave? And I said, no, she's privy to all my affairs. And I then said, thinking she was going to ask me about sex, I said, I haven't had any sex for 35 years. in fact, she was going to ask me my social security number. And she burst into laughter. She said, oh, you poor thing. She said, we must do something about it.
Well, the truth is Oliver didn't do anything about it because he didn't think he could. I mean, he'd chosen Richard, lost Richard, chosen Mel, lost Mel. It wasn't the point, he was thinking. And then finally, and who knows when or why these things happen to people, but a man came along who for the first time chose Oliver.
I had met Billy, as I meet a number of people, because I'd been sent a manuscript or a proof for book, and an intimacy grew between us. I don't think I quite realized how deep it was, but then there was a particular episode in Christmas of 09 when he came up, and in a sort of serious way he has, a serious, careful way, he said, I have conceived a deep love for you.
I have conceived a deep love for you.
Yeah.
That is a sort of a, that's like got a few extra words. I have conceived a deep love for you.
Right. Okay.
Was he scared to say, I love you? Or?
No, he likes the English language. And I think it couldn't have been put more cautiously and yet more strongly. I think it was a beautiful way of putting it. And then I realized at that moment, with his saying that, that I had conceived a deep love for him. And I, among other things, I thought, good God, it's happened again. And I'm in my 77th year.
And, that's amazing.
And,
77.
And what next? And things basically have gone happily ever since. And surprisingly guiltlessly, because then again, I'm not dealing with a what, I'm dealing with a who. I'm dealing with an individual. I'm not dealing with a condition defined by medicine or law.
I want to do one last thing before we close. And this comes from yet another conversation I had with him. And it's a story I know Oliver would hate because he's not a capital R religious kind of guy. But he is somebody who definitely embraces mystery. And for a long time, he's been mystified by a color called indigo.
Indigo, which Newton had inserted between blue and violet. Mm. And no two people seem to agree as to what indigo was like. And so I built up a sort of chemical launch pad.
Meaning he took a lot of drugs.
A base of amphetamine for general arousal, then some acid and a little cannabis. And when I was sufficiently stoned, I said, I want to see indigo now. As if in reply, and as if thrown by a giant paintbrush, there appeared a huge, trembling, pear-shaped blob of what I instantly realized was pure indigo on the white wall in front of me. It had a wonderful luminosity, and in particular, although I'm not a religious person, I thought this is the color of heaven. And I leant towards it in a sort of ecstasy, and then suddenly disappeared.
And he says he had one more moment like that, this time no drugs. He was in a museum staring at an Egyptian artifact. He sees this radiant color back again, just for a beat.
I was given 5 tantalizing seconds of radiant, ineffable beauty.
And then, again, it vanished.
And that was in 1965, and I've never seen indigo since.
But who knows, you know? Someday, I like to think, Dr. Sacks may get to see that color again. We'll be right back.
Hello, this is David from Berlin. Radiolab is supported in part by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation, enhancing public understanding of science and technology in the modern world. More information about Sloan at www.sloan.org.
Radiolab is supported by Progressive Insurance. What if comparing car insurance rates was as easy as putting on your favorite podcast? With Progressive, it is. Just visit the Progressive website to quote with all the coverages you want. You'll see Progressive's direct rate, then their tool will provide options from other companies so you can compare. All you need to do is choose the rate and coverage you like. Quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. Prices vary based on how you buy. Radiolab is supported by Babbel. sometimes self-improvement can feel like a pretty overwhelming journey. So what if this year you just got a tiny bit better every day? When you're learning a new language with Babbel, that's exactly what you're doing. Babbel is a science-backed language learning app with quick 10-minute lessons that have been handcrafted by over 200 language experts to help you start speaking a new language in as little as 3 weeks. You can learn everything you need to have real-world conversations, café s'il vous plaît, from vocabulary words to culture and more. And if Babbel can help you start speaking a new language in just 3 weeks, imagine what you could do in a few months or a full year. Here is a special limited-time deal for Radiolab listeners. Right now, get up to 60% off your Babbel subscription, but only for our listeners at babbel.com/radiolab. Get up to 60% off at babbel.com/radiolab, spelled BABBEL.com/radiolab. Rules and restrictions may apply.
On Death, Sex, and Money, we feature interviews with you, our community of listeners, getting honest about uncomfortable things.
I developed an illness where it isn't safe for me to drive. A friend once said to me, "Sex is like air. You don't think about it until you're not getting enough." This is a similar sort of thing if you just replace sex with driving.
Listen to Death, Sex, and Money wherever you get podcasts.
Hey, I'm Jad Abumrad.
I'm Robert Krulwich.
This is Radiolab. So, Robert, one of my favorite sounds of all time is the sound of hearing people think. You know, of hearing a mind kind of formulate a thought that wasn't there until it
clicks in.
Yeah, and that's just a beautiful sound, especially when the mind that you're listening to is a person who has shaped you, has shaped the show.
Sure.
So we're going to continue our celebration now of Dr. Oliver Sacks. This time, though, with the help of a guy named Billy Hayes, who is a writer and a photographer.
And I was the partner of the late Oliver Sacks. And together we made tapes or recordings of conversations in the last year of his life.
And why? Why did you start these recordings?
Well, Oliver got his diagnosis of a terminal cancer in mid-January 2015.
He had had cancer about 9 years earlier, dealt with it, but it was back and spreading through his body.
The prognosis was 6 to 18 months, and it was shattering.
Shortly after, Bill says they were sitting at the kitchen table talking.
Like, I knew that he had things on his mind that he wanted to write, and I said, "Well, what are you thinking about writing?" This was about 4 days after he got his diagnosis, and he paused. And then he looked at me and he said something like, "A month ago, I felt that I was in good health, even robust health. At 81, I still swim a mile a day, but my luck has run out." And I said, "Stop right there." And I grabbed a pad and a pen and I said, "Start over." And I began writing as fast as I could as he dictated virtually the entire essay.
Wow. Just sort of spilled out like that?
Yeah. And so we had the idea of getting a little audio recorder, a digital recorder, so that it could be on hand at any time, whether to record what he wanted to write or reminisce or to collect stories. After his death, I put the recorder in a drawer and didn't pull it out again until over a year and a half after his death. I didn't even listen to it, any of it, to write my own memoir. I had been kind of very nervous about listening to them because I thought it would be very sad and just that it would just make me depressed and sad. But I took the recorder out of the drawer where it had sat for 18 months and I pushed play, and of course it didn't work because the batteries were dead. So I had to scramble to find batteries, and when I did and then pushed play.
Okay, this is a recorded conversation between OWS and Billy Hayes.
I mean,
on February 6th.
The hairs on my arms went up. It was as if he was alive.
This is the first recording you made with him?
Mm-hmm. It was during dinner. We were eating at the time, and he began telling me about his dreams.
Dreams. I've been having a lot of strangely archetypal dreams of a journey I have to make.
Yeah.
Getting lost and getting found, full of surprises. There may be going through a door, which I think will be a door into another room, but it's a door into a mountain landscape.
Uh-huh.
Sometimes frightening ravines or having to edge along very narrow ledges, but then finally coming to some gracious, heavenly mountain meadow, and then waking. Dreams about journeys, an approaching end, and it's a journey from where to where.
This was February 6th, 2015, so about 3 weeks after Oliver got his diagnosis of a terminal cancer, and his immediate impulse was to write.
And yet, again, this balance has been forced into my mind by the events of the past 2 weeks.
Oliver was quite deaf. Even louder than he realized, he would whisper words to himself as he wrote them down on the pad, and he wrote with a fountain pen. For Oliver, writing was a form of thinking and the primary activity for a human being.
The general feeling of disorder, which goes with them, and which may be tolerably severe, so severe, patients may long for death. And now what happened to my other magnifying glass?
Oliver was the kind of guy who would take dictionaries to bed to read with a magnifying glass.
Can you bring my Chambers dictionary or look up a word for me?
Sure.
You may need a magnifying glass. And I have one here. Aha! I also feel the missing magnifying glass. There it is. Can you see if there's a word, resipiscence? R-E-S-I.
Yes, there is. Change to a better frame of mind. To be wise.
To be wise. Can you pull out the big dictionary and see if you can find any examples? In particular, I want to know whether a return to health.
Okay.
Here was a man with a huge vocabulary and love of writing, but still, every day he would be struck by a word that he wanted to look up.
Well, it immediately says, repentance for misconduct.
What did you say?
Repentance for misconduct, recognition of errors committed, return to a better mind or opinion.
What's the origin of the word?
To recover one's senses, come to oneself again.
Yeah, come to one's senses. I think that's not quite the word I want. Debilitating. Tiredness disappeared. I felt a little return of energy. Homeostasis is coming back. My fucking body, which I had so cursed. Okay, Billy.
Yeah?
Shall I read something to you?
Yes.
A general feeling of disorder. It is especially when things are going wrong internally, when homeostasis is not being maintained, when the autonomic balance starts listing heavily to one side or the other, that this core consciousness, the feeling of how one is, takes on an intrusive, unpleasant quality. And now one will say, I feel ill. Something is amiss. At such times, indeed, everything comes and goes, and if one could take a scan or inner photograph of the body at such times, one would see vascular beds opening and closing, peristalsis accelerating or stopping, viscera squirming or tightening in spasms, secretions suddenly increasing or decreasing, as if the nervous system itself were in a state of indecision. Instability, fluctuation, and oscillation are of the essence in the unsettled state. This feeling of disorder. We lose the normal feeling of... The procedure, though relatively benign, would lead to the death of a huge mass of melanoma cells. These, in dying, would give off a variety of unpleasant and pain-producing substances. Soon after waking from the embolization, I was to be assailed by feelings of excruciating tiredness and paroxysms of sleep so abrupt they could poleaxe me in the middle of a sentence or a mouthful. Delirium would seize me within seconds, even in the middle of handwriting. I felt extremely weak and inert. On day 10, I turned a corner. I felt awful as usual in the morning, but a completely different person in the afternoon. This was delightful and wholly unexpected. I suddenly found myself full of physical and creative energy and euphoria almost akin to hypomania. Exuberant thoughts rushed through my mind. How much of this was a re-establishment of balance in the body? How much an autonomic rebound after a profound autonomic depression? How much other physiological factors? And how much the sheer joy of writing? I do not know. But my transformed state and feeling were, I suspect, very close to what Nietzsche experienced after a period of illness and expressed so lyrically in The Gay Science. Gratitude pours forth continually, as if the unexpected had just happened. The gratitude of a convalescent, for convalescence was unexpected. The rejoicing of strength that is returning, of a reawakened faith in a tomorrow and the day after tomorrow, of a sudden sense and anticipation of a future, of impending adventures, of seas that are open again.
Where's the microphone on this bloody thing? Well, okay, you're recording this, right? The time is 9:20 in New York. It would be 5 hours difference with Greenwich Mean Time. And it is Monday the 9th. That's to say, the 20th day after my embolization, and just 48 hours till the next one. End of recording. Pause.
On March 11th, Oliver had the second embolization surgery, which would cut off blood supply to the tumors growing in his liver, with the idea that it would give Oliver more time, more energy. We'd been together 6 years. I knew him well, and yet I'd never seen him with such focus.
Billy, times, I question.
Just constantly writing.
I don't know what to call this piece. They can title it Ninth Avenue in the Glorious Forest.
No, well, really. I like The Future I Shall Never Know.
Sorry? That's excellent. Yeah, that's it. I think I need to put in, otherwise, just to indicate why I should...
Have some insurance.
And I say to Billy, who is a good deal younger, who is a good deal younger than I am, originally I put who was two-thirds my age, but I have to be precise.
I like that.
Okay.
I mean, that is really precise.
Okay, who is exactly two-thirds my age. Okay, so that's that. A little piece.
For the New Yorker.
Yes.
Okay, have some Ensure and I'll heat your soup.
Thank you.
Sure.
Yeah, I like the idea of saying, Billy, who is exactly two-thirds of my age. It's not a fraction you expect to see. Three quarters, yes. Half, yes. But not two thirds. I like the idea of putting a tiny arithmetical conundrum.
Ninth Avenue Reverie, published March 20th, 2015. driving down 9th Avenue, choking on diesel fumes from a truck just ahead of us, I say to my friend Billy, he is exactly two-thirds my age, I wonder whether you will see the end of internal combustion engines, the end of oil, a cleaner world. The thought zooms me away from 9th Avenue to a forest world. In particular, to the one described in That Glorious Forest, Sir Gillian Prance's book about his 39 visits to the Amazon in the past 50 years. He sees what we are doing to the Amazon and its many peoples. He speaks for conservation, sanity, reason, before we destroy it all. I went to That Glorious Forest in 1996, 11 days of botany, study, and hiking, seeing hundreds of different species of trees in a single acre. I had planned, before I became ill, to go to Madagascar to see its forests and its unique fauna and other wildlife, especially the lemurs. I love lemurs. One has to see them, study them, to grasp the origin of our primate nature. But most of the forests on Madagascar have already been obliterated, and, not unnaturally, the lemurs are dying. Honking horns bring me back to 9th Avenue. I seem to have spent hours lost in reverie, thinking about the Amazonian and Madagascan forests, lemurs, the time machine. But we have scarcely moved, are still behind the stinking, lung-destroying truck. Not in my life, Billy answers.
I've been reading a lot of it aloud to Billy.
This is a recording where Oliver is talking on the phone to Lawrence Weschler, or Ren Weschler.
But anyhow, I was due to have a CAT scan follow-up on Thursday. I was terrified of this. In fact, what it did show was that 80% of the metastases in the liver had been destroyed by the embolization. With luck, I should have 2 or 3 good months after this. I just hope that I can see friends and write and maybe travel a little. And I think next month, if I'm up to it, I'm going to go to London to say hello and possibly farewell to friends and family. And I can't think ahead beyond that. Nine, six, seven. It's still one short. Oh, well, so... semantics... Use of elementary units. Phonemes and its inseparability. Intimate relation.
Ooh, I want to hear, I want to hear.
Over the years, I filled upwards of 1,000 notebooks. Their contents are very various, but 3 of them have had a special function: to record abnormalities of perception during times of sensory impairment or deprivation. The current notebook is a very modest affair. It is quite small and slips easily into a pocket. Crucial, because I need to have it with me at all times. With increasing deafness, I am more and more prone to mishearing what people say. But mishearings deceive one entirely. You accept what you hear, you accept what you see. Every mishearing is a novel, surprising concoction. One never gets used to them. The 100th is as fresh, as absurd, and as thought-provoking as the first. Mishearing became a mishearing. Take the car for a spin became take the car for a swim. I've noted that. Your harness became your highness. Therapist, invertebrate. Tarot cards, pteropods. Big-time publisher was heard as a big-time cuttlefish. I said, did you say a poetry bag? And you said, no, I said a grocery bag.
I love the idea of a poetry bag.
Yes. I'm inclined almost to put them all in.
I think they should all be in.
Yeah. I mean, the sheer mass will make the point that sound trumps everything.
One's surroundings, one's wishes and expectations, conscious and unconscious, can certainly be co-determinants in mishearing. But the real mischief lies at lower levels, in those parts of the brain involved in phonological analysis and decoding, doing what they can with distorted or deficient signals from our ears. These parts of the brain manage to construct real words or phrases, even if they are absurd. And yet, there's often a sort of style or wit, a dash in these instantaneous inventions. They reflect, to some extent, one's own interests and experiences, and I rather enjoy them. Only in the realm of mishearing, at least my mishearings, can a biography of Cancer become a biography of Cantor, one of my favorite mathematicians. Tarot cards can turn into tarot pods, a grocery bag into a poetry bag, all or noneness into oral numbness, and a mere mention of Christmas Eve, a command to kiss my feet.
Oops, no wonder I couldn't write anymore. I must get more cartridges. I'm going through these too quickly.
I want to reassure you, yes. All of these thoughts are already in the draft.
Oh, are they? Good.
Okay? So I think it's time to let your weary mind rest.
Yes. Okay. We'll see each other in the morning.
Okay.
If you could just kiss me whenever I had a dry mouth, I'd be in heaven.
Do you want some more water?
Yes, I better raise my head a little.
My name is Jazz Adam, and I'm calling from Los Angeles. Radiolab is supported in part by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation, enhancing public understanding of science and technology in the modern world. More information about Sloan at www.sloan.org.
Radiolab is supported by Progressive Insurance. What if comparing car insurance rates was as easy as putting on your favorite podcast? With Progressive, it is. Just visit the Progressive website to quote with all the coverages you want. You'll see Progressive's direct rate. Then their tool will provide options from other companies so you can compare. All you need to do is choose the rate and coverage you like. Quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. Prices vary based on how you buy. Radiolab is supported by Betterment. Let's talk about hustle culture. You know, the whole rise and grind, go big or go home thing. It's a lifestyle that may not be for you, but one that your money can handle thanks to Betterment. Betterment is the automated investing and savings app that makes your money hustle. How? Their automated technology optimizes your investments again and again. With Betterment, your money is taking ice baths at 5 a.m. while you get your well-deserved rest. Your money downs protein smoothies and automatically reinvests your dividends, all before you head out the door. Your money is a workaholic, but you don't have to be because you've got Betterment, the automated investing and savings app that makes your money hustle. Visit Betterment.com to get started. Investing involves risk. Performance is not guaranteed.
I think, would you like to pour out some wine for your elderly lover?
Sure. You want some of this?
Yeah.
Okay. You look very happy. Which one of these jackets appeals to you? If you're going to pick one, let's go to the start.
Yeah, well, of course, I have to take my own unfortunate shape.
No. I want you to respond to them. Which one?
Yes. I see.
Do you like
I'm not, I think, as fond of this sort of routine jacket with its pockets and its flaps. Functional, though it is. I don't know where I got that jacket.
It's so hot, Oliver.
Sorry?
It's so hot.
Hot.
Hot. Do you know that word? Sexy.
Yes. Yes, right.
You're very handsome.
You haven't had anything to eat.
Mm-mm.
You should have something to eat.
I might go out. I sort of enjoy that on Sunday night.
Yes, I know.
I get a little stoned and I go out into the neighborhood. Do you mind?
No. I don't know that I'm good for much company anyhow at the moment. Yeah, go rejoice. I wasn't counting how many to do you here.
I didn't count either.
Oliver had enjoyed a couple of really good months of feeling well and fit and getting lots of writing done. He had completed not only A General Feeling of Disorder, the short piece Mishearings, his autobiography On the Move was published. He worked on a piece on the evolution of the eye, and he'd completed a major case history on the performer Spalding Gray. We'd made this wonderful trip to London for 10 days. After we returned from the trip, he knew that he would have to get another CAT scan to see how things were going. And I would say that we kind of had a feeling, an optimistic feeling. He seemed to be doing well. So he went into that hoping for the best, but it was exactly the opposite. The cancer had spread beyond the liver to other organs, that it was looking very bad indeed. Oliver, more than anyone, I think, knew that time was running out.
Billy, I wonder if I can ask you to look up something on the little box.
Sure.
The Ten Commandments. Yeah, in particular the one about keeping the seventh day holy. I'm not sure what his exact wording is.
Remember the Sabbath day to keep it holy?
That's right. Let me just write that down. That's exactly what I want. I don't know if I can see this. Shabbos.
He was having a lot of discomfort and had to have a catheter implanted in his abdomen to drain off fluid that was accumulating from the tumors, which was around August 4th or 5th. It was really the only solution, and it was quite uncomfortable, and it had to be drained daily. And it also, unfortunately, ended his swimming. He was a great swimmer, and he loved to swim. But he didn't complain. Swimming had come to an end, so he put his head down, basically, and began working on this essay, Sabbath.
Surgical identity. Avatar. Early in the day. I think I was doing.
I knew what you were doing. I just wanted to talk to you. Good morning.
Good morning. Did I miss a dramatic reading?
It just started a little while ago.
How are you?
Weak.
His longtime assistant and editor, Kate.
What are you writing about? The Sabbath?
Yeah. It's going to be quite a long piece. It's going to fill an entire pad. My mother, why don't you get a chair? I don't like you looming.
I like standing because it's better
for Okay, fine, stand then.
My back. Should I loom over here?
Okay, yeah.
Okay.
My mother and her 17 brothers and sisters had an Orthodox bringing up. All photographs of their father show him wearing a yarmulke. And I was told that he woke up if it fell off during the night.
Isn't that funny? I love that.
My father, too, came from an Orthodox background. But they were very conscious of the sixth commandment, remember the Sabbath day to keep it holy. And Shabbos, as we called it in our Bitfuck way, was entirely different from the rest of the week. When Shabbos came in, my mother would light candles, cupping their flames with her hands and murmuring a prayer. And I gradually became more distant or indifferent. I think it just more indifferent to Jewish life, the synagogue, the Sabbath, and the synagogue in particular. Though there was no particular point of rupture or alienation until I was 18. It was then that my father, inquiring into my sexual feelings, compelled me to admit that I liked boys. I haven't done anything, I said, it's just a feeling. But don't tell Ma, she won't be able to take it. He did tell her. And the next morning she came down with a look of horror on her face and shrieked, "You're an abomination. I wish you had never been born." The matter was never mentioned again, and a cordiality, even love, was rebuilt. But her brutal, hateful words, her curse, made me hate Judaism, all religions, in their capacity for inhuman bigotry and cruelty. And it turned me in part to a self-hating, self-accusing, closet homosexual. I'd felt a little fearful visiting my Orthodox family with my lover, Billy. My mother's words still echoed in my mind, but Billy too was warmly received, and there was no hint at the terrible bigotry of 60 years earlier. This was made clear by Robert John, and he invited Billy and me to share a Friday evening with him and his family. The peace of the Sabbath, of a stopped world, a time outside time, was palpable, infused everything, and Billy, I think, was as conscious of this as I was. That I'd been able, for the first time in my life, to make a full and frank declaration of my sexuality, that I was finally out of the closet, facing the world openly, with innumerable guilty secrets locked up inside me. And now, weak, short of breath, my once firm muscles melted away by cancer, and my thoughts increasingly not on the supernatural, which has never made sense to me, but on what is meant by living a good and worthwhile life, achieving a sense of peace within oneself, I find my thoughts drifting to the Sabbath, the day of rest, the seventh day of the week, and perhaps the seventh day of one's life, when one can feel one's work is done, and one may, in good conscience, rest.
On August 14th, Sabbath was published in the New York Times. That same day, he began to dictate the table of contents for the River of Consciousness, the collection of essays which he knew would be published posthumously. It was getting his house in order.
I don't know that I'm capable of much writing, nor that I want to do any writing, but I hope I can, as it were, think aloud to you and to Kate, mm-hmm. the recorder. Mm-hmm. Home hospice. I think that I will require an amount of care, including intravenous nursing things beyond what you and Kate can provide mm-hmm. or should. And this in turn should release you to be just my friends and comforters. One last go at tempting my appetite. Can you bring me in a little bit of kedgeree?
Just to mention, there is also chicken soup.
Yes. I probably should have some liquid.
I'll just do a little of each.
Two weeks later, on August 30th, 2015, Oliver Sacks died at home. In the last 7 months of his life, he wrote and published 9 pieces, and there were many, many more that he started but wasn't able to finish.
And some of the essays he wrote are now in a new collection published after he died called The River of Consciousness, and that's just out.
The readers that you heard in the story were Radiolabbers Anna McEwen, Simon Adler, and Bethel Hopte. Thanks also to Mike Pashkash for engineering help. And this piece was produced by Carla Murthy.
Radiolab is supported by Cozy Earth. When you think about summer comfort, words like breezy or soft maybe come to mind. With Cozy Earth's luxurious bedding and loungewear, you'll get the comfort of home wherever you roam, allowing you to elevate your summer getaway no matter where or even if you're getting away. Cozy Earth bedding is temperature regulating and made from top-notch materials, including viscose from bamboo that can turn any living or sleeping space into a sanctuary of luxury and comfort. Their loungewear and pajamas offer you their signature level of comfort while maintaining an elegant fit so you can look cute and be comfy even if you're taking a long flight or car trip. Cozy Earth provided an exclusive offer for Radiolab listeners. Get 35% off site-wide when you use the code Radiolab at www.cozyearth.com. That's 35% off at cozyearth.com, code Radiolab. Discover your next destination for ultimate comfort at Cozy Earth.